Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here across the nation from my flagship station, WSB in Atlanta, Georgia. And the phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. You know, being in Georgia and having had a show that was just a Georgia show for a while, I figured one of the governors, one of the first governors out to say he was going to take a stand against Joe Biden's vaccine mandate was the governor of Georgia. And I figured, why don't we get him on the program and talk about it? Joining me, the governor of the great state of Georgia, Brian Kemp. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon, Eric.
So let's talk about you. You were the first gubernatorial tweet I saw out after President Biden's vaccine mandate speech saying you would take a stand against this. And I know you've been working with other governors to take a strong stand against it, and wanted you to bring us up to speed on it.
Well, really what the president's done is created more chaos. I think he's just trying to distract from the disastrous pullout in Afghanistan, the crisis that we still have on the border, the domestic crisis that we have with runaway inflation and a lot of other issues, not to mention them talking about raising taxes on small business owners and hardworking Georgians and other Americans around the country. But listen, this has created chaos. I mean, we don't even have the rule out yet. All kind of people are calling, going, what does this mean? How are we going to implement this? I have over 100 employees. The folks that are adamant about not getting vaccinated, they're going to quit, go to work for my competitor that has, you know, 60 employees, and then I'm going to be the one that's screwed on this. And it's, you know, typical of this administration. They haven't thought this through. It's going to be a logistical nightmare for companies and HR directors that already have more issues that they're dealing with trying to find enough people to hire now because of the Biden stay at home, you know, get paid at work, you know, by not working policy. And so, you know, we're trying to figure out legally what our options are. We won't really know that until we see what the rule says. But, you know, and I'm like you. I heard you talking earlier, Eric, about the vaccine. I've been vaccinated. It's a medical miracle. Credit goes to President Donald Trump and Operation Warp Speed. And what I'm doing is telling people, look, go talk to your doctor. Nobody trusts the government anymore because of all these mixed messages coming out of D.C., not only on this, but on other things like, you know, get vaccinated, wear your mask, take your mask. You know, now they want to put your mask back on. They said they weren't going to do a vaccine mandate. Now they're doing a vaccine mandate. The vice president said she wasn't going to take the vaccine. Now she's ordering everybody else to take it. It's just insanity.
It not only is it insanity, but it just seems unworkable too. I've talked to a number of businesses and they said, well, number one, there aren't enough OSHA enforcers out there, but two, if the alternative is you got to get tested every week, that we're already in short supply around the nation with the COVID tests again. And employers just don't see any manageable way to do either situation from the vaccine testing and the monitoring standpoint from OSHA or the regular COVID testing.
Yeah, and the thing is that there's many companies already that have programs. You know, there's companies that have already, you know, taking stances on the vaccine or implementing incentives. Local governments are doing that as well. And we've seen that these mandates, you know, the Democrats have been putting them in place. They're not even enforcing them. All it does is create, you know, really disagreement amongst Americans out there that are very opinionated and polarized, quite honestly, because of the mixed messages coming out of the White House. And to me, we don't need to focus on that. You know, we don't need to focus on further dividing the country. And this is the president that said he was going to unite the country. You know, we should focus on being civil and educating people about the vaccine and not trying to bully them into taking it and work at it that way. I mean, that's basically how the AIDS vaccine works. You know, people wouldn't take it early on because it was mandated. They started educating people, and now it's doing a lot of good out there. And it's the same scenario, you know, different year that we're dealing with right now with COVID.
How do you, as an elected official, deal with the growing distrust in government? Because it seems to be on a bipartisan, particularly partisan level. Democrats don't trust Republicans. Republicans don't trust Democrats. How do you try to break through across the distrust?
Well, number one, I've just tried to use common sense and be consistent. You know, these policymakers, including the president and some others around the country that have done one thing and then they go back and do something else and they continue to move the goalposts on people. I mean, you know, the American people and people in Georgia, you know, with a lot of the national policies, have just felt like they're a yo-yo. You know, it's up and down. It's all over the place. And what we've tried to do in Georgia is stay consistent, stay, you know, reasonable, educate people, trust our citizens, trust our businesses, trust our local school districts and other people to take care of this situation and to do the right thing and deal with the situation that's at hand. And normally the best way to do that are with those that are closest to it. The problem is you have people that overreach and you have to deal with that at times. But that's what I've tried to do is just be honest with people and tell them, look, I get it. Don't, you know, I'm not asking you to trust the government. I'm telling you the truth, but I can't make you believe it. But just go talk to your doctor, talk to your local pharmacist, talk to your faith leader, talk to other family members that have gotten the vaccine and just, you know, talk to your local hospital and see what they'll tell you about the facts. You know, what they're telling me is 95% of the COVID patients that we have in hospitals, which is about, you know, 25 to 30% of the census statewide, are unvaccinated. And, you know, there's protection out there for you, but you got to be willing to do that. And I personally don't think the government should be mandating that. It's for each citizen to decide.
Well, along those lines, if you wouldn't mind, talk to us about the hospital situation in Georgia. There have been some concerns around the country and even here that there just wasn't enough capacity in hospitals now because of the COVID situation. And yet all the data right now looks like it's starting finally to recede again in the state.
Yeah, in Georgia, I mean, I've, as you can imagine, been following those numbers daily. And our hospitalizations, the statewide average has been falling the last, I think, probably 4 or 5 days now, which is a great sign. The hospital CEOs that I'm talking to are saying that that's the trend that they're seeing and we're moving in the right direction. We've had a lot of our systems, especially on the coast of Georgia and in South Georgia, where the Delta variant spread first, are starting to really come off with a 20% reduction, maybe even more now. That was just a few days ago when I got that figure. I know a couple of our metro systems are seeing the same. We still have a few hospitals around the state that still have very high volume, but they're starting to see the trend coming off too. And our cases have been dropping. If you look at our, you know, our moving line of the 7-day average of cases, it's going down now as fast as it was going up. And we just want to stay after it and keep it going in that direction and continue to plow through this. And because of us really working so closely with our hospitals and our healthcare providers and staying on top of this, you know, regardless of how fast this variant's spreading, our economy continues to thrive in Georgia. I mean, we've got the lowest unemployment rate of the 10 most populous states. We had a record year for economic development projects in Georgia, $11 billion of new investment, a 5% increase in the number of jobs that are being created in our state. And there's just great opportunity here for people that want to work and be in a great environment, you know, greatest place in the country, I believe, to live, work, and raise your family.
Well, and in that regard, yeah, the economic data coming out of the state, despite the COVID, despite the resurgence of the Delta variant and everything else, we're doing remarkably well as a state.
Well, it's incredible. Our revenues are holding up well, which is why we've been able to fund back money to, you know, education, obviously healthcare, public safety. As you know, I've taken a very strong stance on violent crime in our capital city in Atlanta and going after street racers and, you know, just putting the notion away that the idea of defunding the police and not supporting men and women in law enforcement is a terrible idea. And we're doing something about it in Georgia. And, you know, that's good for business, too.
Yeah, it definitely is. And you mentioned the tax revenue being stable. I know the legislature's got to come back later this year and deal with the redistricting issue. And you had mentioned possibly dealing with a crime issue as well. I mean, what's the status on the consideration for what the legislature may need to deal with?
Well, we're still working with them in that regard. So we remain very open-minded about that. But I will tell you, they've been very supportive of me using millions of dollars out of the Governor's Emergency Fund for our crime suppression unit. We've done over 12,000 vehicle stops. We've been in over 314 chases. We've arrested, you know, I think it's 300 people now that had outstanding warrants, 11 of those for murder. We've recovered stolen weapons. We've impounded, I think, over 600 cars now. And so we're making a dent, and we're continuing to press those at the city. The Atlanta Police Department's been working with us, but we're also pressing the policymakers to join us and join us in this fight to keep our families safe.
Now, last question for you before you get out of here. With all the economic data out there and the healthcare data, it looks like most of the COVID Delta variant situation, it's starting to shift north. It does seem to be seasonal. How do you work with the governors around the state when it comes to combating COVID, particularly now as it's spreading around the country and we've gotten so contentious? You do have to deal with a lot of Democratic governors as well. What's the interplay there at that sort of level?
You know, the main thing I've been doing is talking to my neighbors at what they're seeing, because we're kind of, you know, these waves come and everybody's kind of getting it hit at the same time. And, you know, we saw that in Georgia. It kind of started in Florida and moved up, and then it's moved to Alabama, Tennessee, and it kind of came from some of those states, Mississippi and others, down from Missouri through Texas, Arkansas, and, you know, Mississippi and so on. So I've had great conversations with my fellow governors about what they're seeing, what they're dealing with, just so we knew when it started hitting here, what it was going to be like, you know, kind of looking at their modeling to see how long we thought this would last. That helped us prepare for bed capacity. And really, which was never an issue here, our issue here was, like everywhere else around the country, was having enough staffing. And we've taken some very aggressive actions to get augmented staffing to our hospitals, and then also calling up to 2,500 National Guard to just be support staff in hospitals. Some of that's medical, but a lot of it is just helping, you know, with logistics, pointing people in the right direction, entering data in computers where the medical staff can be caring for patients. And I tell you, it's been a godsend. I hear from the hospital folks every day that they just are so thankful for our National Guard. And I'd remind folks that are listening around the country that we at over 200 of our Georgia National Guard supporting the Border Patrol mission, doing all they can to help in that crisis down there. And, you know, we've had folks building the wall before it was stopped, and certainly a lot of people serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And our, you know, our thoughts and prayers continue to be with those 13 families that lost, some great Americans lost over there in that debacle, and for all that served and those that gave the ultimate sacrifice. We're praying for them and their families as well.
Well, Governor, listen, I know you got a swearing-in ceremony to get to, so I appreciate you being able to take some time out of your day and get to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Governor Brian Kemp, governor of the state of Georgia. Charlie's texting me. He says he's got an appointment to get to, a swearing-in. You need to let him go. So we will let him go, but glad he could stop by. The economic news out of the Southeast is actually remarkable. Georgia, Florida, Tennessee in particular, and South Carolina now showing some real economic growth despite the COVID lockdowns, or not really the lockdowns, just people staying home and staying in place because they were scared of getting the Delta variant. The economic situation in the Southeast continuing to rebound. Texas as well doing great, but not as good as Georgia right now. The governor, had he had time, I'm sure would have pointed that out. All right. I didn't have time to talk to him about the UGA South Carolina game, but we all know who's going to win that. We will be back. This hour of the program brought to you by First Liberty Building and Loan. If you are in charge of the finances of your business and you need access to big loans, and the banks have been telling you no, see if First Liberty can get you to yes. They make their own lending decisions. They've been doing this since the 90s, but we're talking big deals for companies that want to be big, six figures and above. You're buying a building, buying a fleet of vehicles for your company. They want to help you. Go to FirstLibertyGA.com. That is FirstLibertyGA.com. Well, get ready. The Taliban is coming to K Street. That's right. They're hiring lobbyists. A leading figure in the Afghan resistance has retained a Washington lobbyist to seek military and financial support against the Taliban, according to a lobbying contract. Ahmad Massoud, the leader of one of the most prominent groups of fighters seeking to oust the Taliban from power, signed a contract this week with Robert Strike, who built a lobbying practice during the Trump administration, working with clients and others on K Street. I am also told that, well, the Taliban is seeking representation on K Street. Yep, as a matter of fact, here comes this paragraph from the Washington Post. Three lobbyists also say they heard the Taliban is seeking representation on K Street as they seek international funding and legitimacy. They're all going to K Street. Why not to China? You know, the Chinese actually do have a legit concern with the Taliban because the Taliban are true believers. The Uyghurs are Muslim, and the Chinese are exterminating them. they're trying to play nice with the Taliban, hoping the Taliban's desires to have international legitimacy this time and do things slightly different will help them. I'm not sure. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department continues to screw things up. This is from Jim Garrity at National Review. My reader, who is trying to get his company's former employees out of Afghanistan, offers another update and another illustration of the Kafkaesque process of getting an Afghan ally authorization to leave the country. My reader says his senator's office has been helping him get through to employees of the U.S. State Department who might be able to give him more useful information, as his emails are stuck in auto-reply hell, in his words. He was able to get a number for an Afghanistan American citizen legal permanent resident hotline from a call center in Kentucky, area code 606. I suspect it's the State Department's Kentucky Counselor Center in Williamsburg. I explained the situation, he said. A U.S. legal permanent resident since 2017, his wife and kids' visa interviews interrupted by closing of Kabul embassy. Her first response was to read to me verbatim the text of the auto-reply email that we've been receiving. The U.S. embassy in Kabul is closed, blah, 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 blah. I let her do that on the off chance there might be new information. There wasn't. When the woman on the hotline had finished repeating the old, not terribly helpful information, I said, how do we get him and his family out of Afghanistan? My reader says the State Department's hotline operator's advice was to leave Afghanistan, contact any of the neighboring country U.S. embassies, travel to that embassy, finish the interview process, get the visas, then buy tickets and fly to the U.S. My reader replied that step one is impossible without first having a visa, and the Taliban have made it clear no Afghans, like his former employer's wife and children, are allowed to leave, and the northern border is closed to Afghan refugees. She did not have an answer. I'll make one defense of the State Department employee. She didn't establish or get a say in setting the policies. She just gets to be the one answering the calls to the hotline and offering utterly useless recommendations. The plight of these Afghans is now a catch-22. They cannot leave Afghanistan without a visa, and without a functioning embassy in the country, the U.S. government cannot issue them visas, and they cannot get out of Afghanistan to a neighboring country to get visas because the Taliban won't let them. We have so amazingly managed to screw this up. It is remarkable how the Biden administration has done this and how our American bureaucracy continues to screw up. And it's not just them. The FBI bureaucracy as well has failed. Simone Biles talking about this before the U.S. Senate.
We suffered and continue to suffer because no one at FBI, USAG, or the USOPC did what was necessary to protect us. We have been failed, and we deserve answers. Nassar is where he belongs, but those who enabled him deserve to be held accountable. If they are not, I am convinced that this will continue to happen to others across Olympic sports. In reviewing the OIG's report, it truly feels like the FBI turned a blind eye to us and went out of its way to help protect USAG and USOPC.
It is remarkable how the FBI let down those Olympians, and it has a lot to do with our bureaucracy. Across the board, these stories crop up from the State Department to the FBI. The bureaucracy is increasingly dysfunctional and needs to be cleaned up, and no one has the will to do that. Welcome back. It is Eric Erickson across the United States from this microphone. The phone number is 877-973-7425. Joining me, I'm excited to be able to talk to Lila Rose of Live Action about Texas and a whole lot more. Welcome to the program again.
Thanks so much for having me on. Great to be on with you.
So I want to talk to you about the Texas thing from a number of angles, one of which is the absolute media hysteria over the fact that the plaintiffs ultimately, according to the Supreme Court, sued the wrong people, and you would never know that's actually what happened.
There's been total media meltdown because this law has actually gone into effect. The Supreme Court didn't stop it. They have allowed it. Every single day, the Texas heartbeat law is in effect. Over 100 children are saved from abortion because abortion is now banned after 6 weeks in the state. And you see every pro-abortion media friend and ally, celebrity, and even some business leaders in meltdown mode. And it's just tragic. It's tragic when the fact is 46% of Americans, Rasmussen did a poll last week, Eric, 46% of Americans support this law. Only 43% oppose it. So more Americans support Texas's pro-life law than oppose it. And yet you wouldn't think that when you look at the media coverage.
Well, I want to talk about both aspects, the polling and the media coverage here. The polling, people don't understand, you would never understand or appreciate that Gallup has done polling, as have others, for a number of years, and majority of American women consider themselves pro-life.
Yeah, it's definitely more women, depending on the poll, because it kind of shifts in. But it's basically neck to neck. Women identify as pro-life as much as they identify as pro-choice, or sometimes more. You find the same demographics with Gen Z and millennials. Huge groups of Gen Z and millennials consider themselves pro-life. And this is despite the fact that our institutions, you know, our public school system, Hollywood, most news media, you know, the whole Democratic Party are hardcore pro-abortion. So it's actually pretty amazing when you think about it. The tech companies, you know, Google and Facebook COO giving millions of dollars to Planned Parenthood. It's actually amazing how many young people and women are pro-life, despite the crazy propaganda and misinformation out there.
I mentioned after the Texas law passed my experience on television. I was at CNN for 3 years, and whenever an abortion issue would come up, they would always come to me and say, come on, you're our in-house pro-lifer. And I'd be like, Charmaine Yost, Marjorie Dannensfeller, Penny Nance, here are all these women you can have on to be against the woman who would otherwise just say, I'm trying to control her body. And inevitably, miraculously, they would never seem to be able to get a single woman to come on and would go find another man. The media really willfully tries to stage the argument to help the pro-abortion cause.
Yeah, well, you're not too bad, Eric. I'm sure you did a great job defending the pro-life position. But no, you're right. I mean, I have not received a single invite from any left-leaning or even you could call it mainstream cable or network TV to discuss this issue of the heartbeat law. And that should tell you something when, you know, Live Action, I mean, not to brag here, but Live Action is the largest digital news group and educator on pro-life. I mean, we have, you know, over 5 million followers. We're reaching 50 million people a week. We're behind the scenes working on all these fronts. And yeah, I mean, the lack of representation of the fact that most American women, or at least it's, again, half and half, American women are pro-life. And the lack of representation in these newsrooms, on these channels, people that are on, in entertainment media, where, you know, you name it, is really ridiculous. And then the Democratic Party. I mean, you have someone like Senator Katrina Jackson, who's a state senator from Louisiana, who's been, like, disowned by her party because she's a Black woman who dares to be pro-life and a Democrat. And she's very outspoken about it, but the Democrats have totally rejected her, and they've rejected all the Democratic women who are pro-life. So it's really sad to see, but it's a state of affairs where you have this this vice grip that the abortion industry has on politics today, on news media, on education, and that's what we're doing every day at Live Action to try to break.
I have one time remarked on TV, and I remember it was super controversial at the time when I said it, which just seems so quaint given what I said, and it was just that you're far more likely to find a pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage Republican out there in the wild than you are to find a pro-life, pro-traditional marriage Democrat out there in the wild. And man, I remember the Democrats and even the anchor on CNN at the time, I think it was Brooke Baldwin, they acted in disbelief and incredulity, like I had said something just absolutely factually not true. And they couldn't name a single Democrat they could think of on the national stage who's pro-life.
Exactly. And it's not because they don't agree. There's not some that aren't pro-life or Democrats. There are a lot of people in entertainment and news media who I think are secretly pro-life.
Yeah.
But if you come out and say you're pro-life, you get attacked. I mean, look, the head of a video game company, a popular video game company last week, I don't know if you saw this story. He came out and he said, well, a lot of other people, he's the founder of this company, and I'm not into video games, so, you know, it is just one of the popular ones. Anyways, he comes out and says on Twitter, you know, a lot of my colleagues are expressing their outrage at the Texas law. I'm expressing my support. Children deserve protection. He's very measured, very kind, just saying, I support the Texas law. Within a week, he is let go. I mean, his board is publicly announcing that he's stepping down, and you know, they're going to open a safe space for people to talk about how they felt about his statement, you know, and it's just ludicrous. I mean, It is ludicrous. Like, the privilege here is on the pro-abort people whose mothers chose life so they get to live and breathe and walk the earth and live another day, who get to advocate for the killing of children, and society claps for them. Well, the pro-life movement, because these institutions are so corrupt, is getting attacked. But despite all of that, the pro-life movement grows. Texas is getting stronger for life. More and more states are passing pro-life laws. The pro-life movement is growing. So even though they attack and they shame and they try to stop us, we're not going away, and we're gonna make this country pro-life. That is the end game here, so that every child is protected.
Amen to that. Now, moving on with the media coming after you guys, Google has gone into overdrive censoring the pro-life cause. I actually, until you were telling me in commercial break, I guess someone mentioned in passing the story to me the other day. I didn't really understand what they were talking about and didn't have time to go back to it. So you'll be educating me here along with the listeners on this.
Well, it gets so convoluted because, first of all, there's so much tech censorship that happens. And then there's also just concerns about tech censorship where it actually doesn't pan out to be tech censorship. You know, it's kind of the boy who cried wolf. So it's hard to know, like, what actually is happening. But this case is very clear-cut. It just happened this week, and it involves Google, the biggest search engine, one of the biggest tech companies in the world, on the planet. And here's what happened. So Live Action has been advertising this hotline for abortion pill reversal, which has been around for years. It's developed by medical professionals. The hotline is managed by medical professionals, and they use an FDA-approved drug, progesterone, which helps for healthy pregnancies, to help treat the devastating impact of the first abortion pill. So the abortion pill is very popular with abortionists. They try to get women to do it. It's two pills. The first one kills the baby, blocks progesterone. The second one forces a miscarriage. Well, progesterone can counteract in 68% of cases, up to 68% of cases, can save the life of that baby if the woman who regrets the abortion takes progesterone in enough time to block that mifepristone, that first abortion drug. So we're out there, Live Action, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars promoting this hotline. Meanwhile, abortionists, Planned Parenthood, are spending millions of dollars and more promoting abortion pills. We're promoting the hotline. Women are calling in. Over 2,000 have already saved their babies using this technology. And Google gets a call from the Daily Beast, a very pro-abortion rag, saying that, oh, how could you allow this misinformation from pro-lifers on your, you know, search engine? Stop it, please. We demand. And Google, within the day, this is just this week, shuts down all of Live Action's and our partner group's ads promoting this hotline, citing, you know, unreliable claims or whatever gobbledygook they cite. So we're, you know, at war to advertise this. Google's pretending they're being neutral. They're obviously not. They're letting abortion pills get promoted, but not the pro-life antidote, FDA-approved drug progesterone. You know, they're citing pro-abortion doctors claiming that this is not reliable technology. I mean, of course, they're going to say that. They don't want women to regret their abortions or, you know, to take this pill. So it's pretty bad. It's bad. Google's made a choice for women, and that choice is abortion.
It's unfortunate that so many of the tech companies out there lean so far left that you can't even get a fair hearing. You can't in the media either. Well, and yet still so much of the country, we've managed to hang on as a pro-life cause without being wiped off into a vast minority. What keeps you going in this, and how do you try to overcome these situations?
Well, first of all, every single life saved keeps us going. We get messages almost every day that, you know, pro-life content, Live Action videos, stories, news articles, you know, the abortion pill reversals, a woman takes that progesterone treatment, she saves the life of her baby. I mean, when you hear a story of a life being saved, directly or indirectly because of your work, there's no greater joy, right? There's no greater honor. So that keeps you going. But yeah, we got to have a strategy here, and we're working on it. Look, we try to work back channels. We try to, you know, we don't want to go to war with Google. We're at war with abortion, not Google, right? And Google claims to be neutral, that they're still claiming that. They're still claiming that. And they're lying. So really our job is to publicize this, to be relentlessly hopeful and persistent, because when the truth is in front of people, they do change their minds. We see it all the time on abortion. It's a lot of ignorance and misinformation out there, but when information is put out that's correct on abortion, people become pro-life. We see it every day. So yeah, it's relentless work, working every channel we can. We're looking at legal options. I mean, 11 senators have actually sent the leadership at Google a letter demanding that they stop this censorship of the abortion pill reversal technology. So We're working every angle, and we've had reversals in the past. We've had things banned by tech companies in the past that have been reinstated. So there is hope, and we're just going to keep working it.
That's fantastic. Listen, I appreciate so much you being able to stop by and also educating me. I'm going to pay attention to this Google issue because it is new to me, and I'm not surprised. Hopefully they will reverse it, but keep up the good work. I'm such an admirer of what Live Action does and how you've just dedicated yourself to this cause.
Thank you so much, Eric. Thanks for being so outspoken.
Absolutely. You too. Lila Rose, head of Live Action and one of the great pro-life advocates in this country. I want to highlight something that she said, that she has not been asked on these news networks talking about Texas or anything else. It is remarkable to me. It continues to amaze me how these news networks in the country work overtime to make sure that they stage the conversation on abortion to always have a man as the pro-lifer if they can. It is very, very rare to have a pro-life woman. And there are so many of them. Most of the major pro-life organizations in the country, including Live Action with Lila, are helmed by women. And you would never know that. It'll be me or Tony Perkins or some other guy on television defending the issue as opposed to Marjorie Dannensfeller with SBA or Penny Nance with CWA or you name it, any of the great women out there who are great advocates for the life cause, the media would prefer that they not be there because they want to stage the debate and make there seem like it's always the men trying to control women's bodies, which is nonsense. It's not their body we're trying to control. It's the other body we're trying to protect. Hi there, it is Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-973-7425. You probably actually don't have enough time to take a phone call right now. I'm sorry. I want to actually talk about something. If you got a daughter in particular, if you have a son as well, I want you to follow along with me here with something. The Wall Street Journal has out a report on Facebook and Instagram, and that Facebook knows there's a problem on Instagram, particularly with younger girls and their self-esteem issues and leading to all sorts of problems. And I think that's true, but I don't know that Facebook is really the culprit. After all, it's parents who let their kids get on and start accounts. We did with our children, in particular, my daughter, we let her start a Facebook account or an Instagram account. Now, you're technically got to be 13, and We let her start one and might have put in the wrong year for her birthday, but it had to be locked and everybody in the family had to follow in case she did something that was inappropriate. We had to have access to look at the private messages. And as she's gotten older, she started her own account. She's at the age where she was able to start an account on her own, and we monitor it and we have talked to her about this and something a lot of parents don't. Very typically, when you look at someone on Instagram and their accounts, it is highly curated, best life now stuff. It's the Joel Osteen of the internet, of social media. You're displaying your best life now. And the result of this is kids see other kids who want to be influencers in their perfectly curated life, and they become jealous, self-conscious, concerned, develop phobias, bad habits, disorders, because they're living vicariously through someone else. And I see this. I know this from myself. My wife knows this. You know this, particularly if you're on Instagram. You follow someone you don't know. You're regularly interacting with that person on Instagram. You begin to think of that person as someone you do know, even though you don't know that person. And you're living vicariously through their well-groomed, well-crafted life. You rarely do you see the dark side of someone's life on Instagram. I occasionally, if I screw up a meal or something, I try to put it on Instagram just so y'all don't think that I am always perfect in what I cook. I usually am, just to be clear here. But this is one of those brave new world issues you got to deal with your kids. And you've got to talk to your kids about it. Make sure they understand that what they're seeing isn't the real world. It is pretend in so many cases. It is a world that can be deeply corrupting online. And Facebook realizes this, but what do they do about it? I mean, parents are letting kids do this. The number of people I know who it's not their kids, they bring up it's people they know who are allowing their kids to be influencers. I hate the word. I am technically an influencer. I got 15 some odd thousand followers on Instagram, 200 some odd thousand followers on Twitter, and a bunch on Facebook. I don't keep up with it on Facebook, how many people there are. And I've got verified accounts even on Instagram. I'm the only blue check mark on Instagram. Most of my friends and my kids' friends know, which gives me some sort of status with my kids' friends. They're like, oh, your dad's got a blue check mark on Instagram? Yes, I do. Doesn't matter. Or at least it shouldn't. The fact that it does to some people says it's problematic, and it's something you've got to deal with kids. We live in a world where people overshare and are overexposed to a degree, and it's starting to have real world psychological problems. There's a book, and now all of a sudden I can't remember all of a sudden the name of the book, but I think it's called iGen, pointed out that the rate of teen suicide spiked several years ago. And if you want to put your finger on a moment, there was no like national global event as to when it happened. I mean, there was no big like global thing that would cause kids to fall into despair. But in 2007, Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone. January 9th of 2007, it came out that summer. And the next year or so, there was an app store, and things like Instagram and Snapchat and stuff started to be developed, and you started to see the suicide rate of teenagers go up. Why? Well, the speculation in this book, and I think it's credible speculation, is that prior to the iPhone generation, if kids in your kid's school had a party and your kid wasn't invited, they didn't know. Now your kid's at home alone. All the kids said, no, nothing's going on this weekend. And your kid's suddenly seeing these other kids at parties having fun. Your kid wasn't invited. It causes despair and depression. Teen bullying can now happen digitally through private message that you, the parent, may not be aware of. You have got to engage with your kids in ways our parents did not engage with us. I was tying my son's tie this morning for a child. He's 12. He goes to a Christian private school. They have chapel, had to tie his tie. And I thought, you know, I don't really remember. Well, I didn't live in an environment with that. And I remember for years I wore clip-on ties as a kid because my dad worked offshore a lot. And it was a while before I learned how to tie a tie. And my mom didn't know how. So I got clip-on ties. And having this hands-on time with my kid is meaningful to me in a way I couldn't with my dad due to his job. And you with the online, my parents never had to talk to me about this stuff. I'm the generation having to learn to talk to my kids. And I'm telling you, you got to talk to your kids about this stuff.